Welcome, friends. Welcome back to our cast. This is your host, Ron Jacobs, where I am the world, traveling the countryside, searching every nook and cranny for evidence and information of architecture to bring to you, my listeners. Because hey, if this thing isn't valuable, just turn it off, okay? You're not going to listen. But the numbers are going quite well, and I'm quite happy to say that many of you are listening. And it always makes me feel really good to know that what I'm doing is helping people, helping get better results. And today I got to talk to Denny Boynton, who is an architect with, let's just say a big outfit out there in the Midwest. And we just had a lot of fun talking about how some of the work I've done helped him out. So let's welcome Denny Boynton. Welcome back to our cast. Hey, this is your host, Ron Jacobs, coming to you from the North American Architect Forum, where we're in just this big room, and everybody's like staring over there. Like, what are those guys doing over there? They must be talking or something, or kind of nagging, or like bugging everybody. You know, we had the idea that some folks actually might listen while we were doing this. But it doesn't appear that that's happening.
Well, this is the collaboration room. There's a lot of collaborating going on.
I guess so. Yeah. You can't hear it? You can hear it now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. All right. Well, so I am joined today by Denny Boynton. Did I say that right?
Correct.
Hey, that's good.
Very
so
good.
Tell me about yourself, Denny. Where are you from? What do you do?
I'm from St. Louis, and I work for a large beverage company in St. Louis.
Okay.
I can't give the name of the company. The lawyers will be up my rear end
when
I get back
to
St. Louis.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I work in the enterprise architecture team for this company, and so pretty much my day-to-day work is with kind of doing a lot of coaching and mentoring for application architects, trying to help them be successful. We got a fairly compartmentalized IT group broken out by business domains.
Okay.
So we go out and try to work with application architects to improve quality, provide consistent architectural approaches, things of that nature. So
Right. So here's the fun thing. So you were telling me earlier that you came to TechEd last year, and you came to attend the session that I gave called Patterns for SOA,
mm-hmm.
where I covered some principles and anti-patterns and patterns. And you actually went and took this talk and kind of went out and gave it to some of your colleagues, right?
Yeah, I grabbed a lot of the key concepts. And I should say, like, the first time I think I saw you speak, you were with John DeVatos. I think it was 2003
when you
gave that talk at TechEd.
Uh-huh.
What I was really looking for were practical, hands-on, you know, where the rubber hits the road kind of stuff that we could bring back, because we were talking about SOA then.
Yeah.
But we weren't really sure. You know, developers said, okay, the clouds and the lightning bolts between the clouds look great, the diagrams look terrific. How do we implement this? How do we make this work?
Right.
So when I saw your presentation last year and we were actually talking about patterns for implementing services, that's what I want to bring back. That's what I want to try to pass on to my organization, because we were, you know, when you talked about, for example, the cruddy anti-pattern,
uh-huh.
I had just 2 weeks before seen that exact anti-pattern in production causing problems, and I said, okay, so really what I did is I took some of the concepts that you had in the talk, and I reformatted it for our particular organization, and then over the course of the next couple months, I spent a lot of time doing code reviews and architecture reviews for folks, and I started to find other anti-patterns, so I just said the talk is kind of built up, so I did it several times within my company, and then also went out and there's some like local the stlouis.net user group delivered it there as well.
Oh, fun.
Showing people, you know, this is what the implementation of this anti-pattern looks like.
You know, and just so for people who didn't get to hear that, on my personal website on ronjacobs.com, there's a page where I have called Talks, and there's a link for the slides from TechEd. You can download those, and also a link to a webcast that I did about the same topic.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're coming to TechEd this year, I'm giving a new, revised, and updated version of the same talk that now, you know, uses WCF and those kind of things. Because it was funny when I put this together. Gosh, it was just for a VS Live Orlando, I think, almost 2 years ago. And it was the kind of thing when I got up and gave that talk, I thought instantly, I could see like light bulbs going off over people's heads. I go, this thing really works, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I gave that same talk probably 15 times around the world, all kinds of places like in Brazil and in Bangkok and in Australia and other places. It's just like amazing. But it's kind of, it's not rocket science, but it's just kind of fundamental beginnings.
Well, it's got the power that I think any anti-patterns do. Anti-patterns always ring true because people, I've seen that. You know, I've seen that exact,
yeah,
That you know, those mistakes. And when I give the talk, I always talk about the fact that all the anti-patterns come out of the concept of the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Sure.
And in each case, you've got architects who are trying to do the right thing, but they're just not factored in a way that makes sense for the particular problem they're trying to solve. So, for example, the cruddy anti-pattern. I actually reviewed a web service where the team said, I'm working with fairly complex data. I'm gonna virtually federate some of that data that are out there in different databases. So what I want to do is take the data access layer of my application and make a web service out of it.
Yeah.
So they had 60 web methods on the interface, and they were all, you know, delete customer, get customer, update customer. And so they created essentially this very RPC style and, you know, very, very chatty, very tightly coupled in the constructs of it. So they named all the property names the same things as the database columns.
When
the database columns changes, they wanted to be consistent, so they would update the service and break everything that was talking to the service. So it was things like that. Now, conversely, on the pattern side, document processor, when I do my talk using your work.
So hang on a second.
Okay, I'm sorry, good.
For those who are listening, they're going, what are they talking about, cruddy interface?
Sure.
Okay, so the cruddy interface anti-pattern is a pattern that says, you know, if we just begin with a very database-centric view, like I have a customer database, and I say, okay, well, we're going to create some web services for this. So we'll create, you know, add customer, read customer, update customer, delete customer, you know, kind of the classic database operations. And so we think about our web services as kind of a thin layer over the ADO.NET code that's going to update these things. And it just tends to introduce people into the wrong factoring, right? And they get into a place where their service adds little or no value. It's like, why don't you just give people access to the database so they can just do the update themselves, you know,
right.
and something like that.
The other side of that particular anti-pattern is the idea that in many cases people begin to insinuate some sort of state management within the service for specific consumers.
Yeah.
And you know, we've seen web methods called move next.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
You know, totally, you know, that makes a lot of sense inside of the data layer of an application that's maintaining that state for you, but definitely not. So it's the wrong factoring for a web service.
Yeah, so the thing I found that what I observed people doing was kind of taking the knowledge they had about things that worked well in the component-oriented world, in particular when you were in or near the same process, right? Maybe you're on the same machine but different processes or maybe even in the same process. A technique that works well in that world kind of falls apart badly when you move it into the service-oriented world. But, you know, people begin with what they know, and so they take what they know to this new world and try to make it work.
Sure. I talked to a group of students at the University of Missouri-St. Louis a couple weeks ago and did the talk, and we were talking about the cruddy anti-pattern, and we were looking at sort of that RPC style. I said, you know, can anybody tell me why, you know, we were going through what's wrong with this? And well, the one thing that every student in that room forgot about was the wire that was connected between the consumer and the web service, and that every time you're gonna consume, you know, some aspect of that service, there's SOAP being generated, it's being sent over the wire, there is a performance impact to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that kind of got us into this idea of coarse-grained interfaces, you know, on front-facing consumer services.
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting about this whole thing is how people have just had a hard time shifting the mindset. And of all the anti-patterns that I've described, I got so much flack over the cruddy one. I haven't had people argue with me, no, but we need that. And I say, of course you need to update customers, right? Mm-hmm. You need to. I mean, you have a customer database, they move, they change addresses, they change phone numbers, whatever. You need to update those. But you have to think about the process of updating them as more than just updating the physical record in a database. But it might involve a lot of things. Like if they move from one jurisdiction to another, maybe they have different tax rates. Maybe there are different legal things that apply to them now that didn't apply before. Maybe they have a different account team.
Right.
Maybe there's 50 different things that have to happen because somebody moved, and a lot of business rules associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think about updating the customer address as a business process that needs to happen because somebody moved, right? But it's not just I'm updating a record in the database.
Right. I feel this is so important to go out and really evangelize for, especially for application, you know, project level architects and especially developers, you know, because developer, we all know that, you know, whatever plan you hand developers, they'll always go in and, you know, oh, well, that's, you know, I'm going to do it this way.
Yeah.
But to get across this idea that if your organization is publishing web services, you're building sort of the foundational layers of a service-oriented architecture.
Right.
And by factoring these interfaces using best practices and the patterns and avoiding the anti-patterns, I think what you're really doing is you're beginning to kind of create the plug in points for your future SLA, and that's kind of where it's something I'm very, very passionate about, and I'm very working very hard to try to, you know, normalize and get our organization to start thinking about, you know, get some of those cultural changes that have to happen within our organization to facilitate that. So that's really kind of my thing is if we do this, you're going to have correctly factored services, you're going to have you're going to have the better performance, but let's think a little bit down the road. These things are going to plug into a more service-oriented model much better than, you know, if you're doing cruddy or especially, you know, I know we've been talking about the tightly coupled cruddy, but the loosey-goosey anti-pattern, which is essentially, you know, pass some blob in, get some blob back out, there's no contract in place and things like that. That can be as problematic as, you know, having more of a finely grained service interface.
So one of the things I did when I updated this talk for this year's Tech Ed is I looked at some principles, and I thought about every time I give this talk, what do I keep saying? And one of the things I kept coming back to is relying on implicit behavior is evil. It's like, you know, you go, well, what does that service do? Well, every time I call it, it does this. Mm-hmm. Well, does the contract say it's supposed to do that? No, not really, but it always does that.
Right.
I'm relying on that. Well, that's implicit behavior, and that's relying on that introduces a tight coupling that's undesirable because implicit behaviors are often easily, sometimes accidentally, changed over time.
Mm-hmm. That's the really ironic thing about that particular anti-pattern that I found is people factor the service that way to make it loosely coupled. I want it to be flexible.
Yeah.
So pass in an XML document, for example.
Right.
There's another anti-pattern that I've added which really just sort of extends loosey-goosey, which I call it the black hole.
Uh-huh.
A real life scenario where there was one web method on the interface.
Yeah.
And it was called execute method. And it took an XML document as a single parameter and returned an XML document back, and the consumer passed in what business operation they were supposed to put in there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the usual things, it was security through obfuscation. But the real ironic thing about this particular line of anti-patterns is you're trying to make things very loosely coupled for people, but you end up tightly coupling them because of the semantic necessity to understand what the service does. I can't look at the WSDL and really understand what it is I'm supposed to send and what it is I'm going to get back.
Yeah, and so it's funny that you mentioned that because when I revised loosey-goosey for this year, I just created what I called the Uber service, which was exactly what you described. Big service takes an XML document and returns an XML. It's the only service you'll ever need, right? You could write this, and it's the end of the story.
You can do anything, right?
Well, you know, and we said that if you had to pick up the phone and call the guy who wrote that service and say, what does this thing do?
Mm-hmm.
Or what should I send it, or when am I going to get back? If you had to have those kind of out-of-band conversations, then the contract, it becomes kind of meaningless because it's not specific enough.
Exactly.
Well, okay, so the one pattern that I kind of recommended to people, and I struggled to think about, all of this sprang out of conversations I was having one day with some people at Microsoft were thinking about, well, how do we tell people, you know, people are always asking, well, what kind of service should I create? And we go, it's really hard to answer that question, right?
Depends.
It depends what you're trying to do. But it reminded me of the kind of conversations we used to have when people first started doing object-oriented programming. And they go, well, what kind of object should I create? And what kind of hierarchy should I have? And we all came to the conclusion it's easier to tell people what not to do than it is to tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I used anti-patterns as a way to kind of slice off whole areas of bad practice. And then I said, you know, if we think about how did people do business before we had computers? Like go back 50, 100 years, people were doing business, right? They had insurance, they had banks, they had stock exchanges, they were buying, selling things. Somehow it all got done, right? And they didn't have computers to do any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they used paper. And they would write down what they wanted, and they would take papers to someone and give them that paper. And that message said what they wanted to have happen. Now, it got there kind of slowly, and because of the way things worked, they certainly wouldn't be synchronous. They wouldn't be waiting around for it to get done. They would just give them the paper and go away. But this paper had to be a very granular message that kind of said what you wanted to have, and everything you needed to tell about that business operation had to be on that paper, because it wasn't like they were going to pick up the phone and call you back and go, oh, you forgot to say, you know, do you want A or B or something like that. Now, you mentioned that, so I called this pattern document processor, because I was thinking, well, what am I going to, it's funny to think about how do you name a pattern. So I just named it document processor because I thought, well, I want people to think about sending and receiving documents that drive business process. Mm-hmm. You were telling me earlier that this really helped some of your projects that you've been working with.
Right. The primary benefit of document processors is it starts getting people thinking in that messaging context. It gets them, I think it also influences their thinking about contract as well. Mm-hmm. Because just like you were saying, you know, in any large company, you've got forms for everything. And people are used to filling out forms, but they don't make that mental, you know, that cognitive connection to the fact that when you're making a request on a web service, you're really sending a form in to get some work done, and then you're going to get something back for that. So what I've found is there's initial resistance because it's a little more work. I've also been talking up. You've made the suggestion, at least if you're using Visual Studio, and we have a heterogeneous environment like everybody, but we have the majority of our work is done in .NET. If folks are using Visual Studio, create messaging classes, document carrier objects that don't really do any work but mainly hold that data, because when they get built, they get included inside of the WSDL and gives you that very clear definition at the WSDL level of what this particular operation of work is going to expect as a request and exactly what you're going to get back as a response. And, of course, within the tools, you can use those things, use IntelliSense and all that other all the other benefits that you get from that. But what we're seeing is I'm seeing a reduction in this idea of creating kind of the old style of I'm going to have 14 parameters built into this method, and, you know, if I change that, you know, the WSDL gives me a little bit of loose coupling, but now I'm in a position now where I am actually changing a method signature. Things can go wrong there if we're not real careful about it. Creating things as messages gives us a lot more flexibility, so we get the loose coupling without being too loosely coupled, but we can also get the granularity of the messages in and the messages out without being very RPC style. So I think it's a great convergence of those solutions to those particular problems.
Well, and as you kind of move to this kind of thinking, I think the most important part of this is to shift people's thinking. For years and years and years, we've been thinking about I'm invoking a method on a remote object. Mm-hmm. And people carry that thinking into web services, and they go, oh, the web service is just a remote object.
It's a natural leap, right? You know, it feels the same. You know.
Yeah, and if you write a method signature that looks like a method on a remote object, it kind of fits that pattern, right?
Right.
But one of the things that works, it turns it works out very well for moving to Windows Communication Foundation, that there's this idea of a data contract. So I can create a type. I can say this is the data contract that represents the body of my message. And so when I see a method signature that accepts a message, it returns a message. Mm-hmm. Now I've got people thinking the right way. And then you're going to take that message apart. You're going to crack the message. You're going to use it to populate internal objects. You're going to do all kinds of stuff in your business logic layer. After you get past the facade of the web service, you don't even care about the messages, right? And you shouldn't care. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't use them in there. But at the boundary, when you come to that boundary, then you're going to populate your message thing and send it on the wire. So I think it causes people to think about the problem the right way.
Right. Well, it also, I mean, you just hit it right on with the explicit boundary. You know, always, you know, do good OO work inside the boundary but not out.
Yeah.
That was the other, I mentioned before, that was the other anti-pattern I came up with. It was called OO no, which is where you basically take your whole OO structure and use that as the transport mechanism. And we've seen some problems with that as well, as you can imagine. But when And you know, by taking the input and the output of a particular service and having to load those things into these messaging structures, mm-hmm. it gets people thinking about the transport that has to happen.
Yes.
And I think that's really where a lot of folks with, you know, when we see services that's, you know, the wheels start to fly off of them and they stop working correctly, it's because they were factored more that people weren't thinking about that transport element and maybe not also thinking about the versioning challenges that may come down the road to factoring the service in that particular way. So it's, you know, more and more I'm finding if we can get the factoring of that service interface correct, I think most people know what to do behind the boundary.
Yeah.
I think most consumers of the service know what to do with the data when they get it back.
Yeah.
But we're finding that where we run into the most problems is the factoring of that interface and getting that part right. And so that's really where, you know, I wanted to come up and talk to you today.
Oh, sure.
Because that's, you know, that's been real important for us within our organization.
Well, you know, it seemed to me if I step back for a minute and I say, well, what is the goal? And when a lot of people set out to do service orientation, they looked at the goal the wrong way. I think they looked at it like some people said, oh, well, this is going to replace object orientation. And so, you know, now we're going to have services everywhere. Everything's going to be a service. So my data layer is a service. My business objects are now services. And everything is service, service, service. And so that was kind of a bad idea, right? But if we said, well, what is the goal for these services? And to me, it felt like I'm kind of visualizing here. So for those on the radio, I'm waving my hands in two cones, in two circles, right? These two circles represent two systems, right? In these systems, there's churn. They're constantly changing, they're churning, they're getting updated, they're getting bug fixes and things like that. But I need these two systems to work together, to be linked together. What I don't want is instability in the links. I want the links to be rock solid, stable mm-hmm. over long periods of time. Even though the systems are churning, I don't want any of the churn that's going on inside to affect the boundary links between these systems.
Right.
And that's when we run into, you know, surprise, the way you designed your thing, the internal churn now caused the link to break. And that's what causes a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm. There's this comes back to, one, I think, one of the selling points when we start talking about services is, you know, we're a large company. We've got a lot of siloed applications. We've got data everywhere. You know, we've got a data warehouse, but we need data in this environment, so we move data into that environment. And this idea of being able to build that abstraction and hide all that churn that's going on in the background, you know, the idea of being able to retire databases, very intriguing, even to operations folks who ordinarily they don't, you know, just I'll build you a server where you can put that stuff. That's what they care about. But even when we start talking about, hey, if we start building some of these things, you can provide some of this infrastructure, this will make your lives easier too. I think it's a great sell even to them that, hey, you know, you guys can move things around as long as you're, you know, working with the AD teams that are managing and supporting these services. You know, you can actually begin to shut things down that right now you've got people going directly into that data. You know, you're kind of stuck. You kind of have to leave it up until, you know, the next budget cycle when maybe these folks can get some money and then go in and refactor to get it from somewhere else.
You know, the picture I used to describe boundaries in this presentation was international borders. And mm-hmm. I tell this funny story about when I went to Canada and got all kinds of hassles at the border. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking about, it's a good picture because countries think pretty hard about their border crossings. You can't just walk across at any random, well, you can, but you might get in trouble.
You're not supposed to.
We have some issues with that ourselves, right?
Right.
But, you know, they don't want people just crossing any random place, right? And they want to put controls on where you can cross and when you can cross and what is the process for crossing and what kind of evidence you have to produce that you're allowed to cross and those kind of things. It's interesting because these crossings become entangled in all kinds of relations between the countries, right? And so if one country kind of ignores the crossing desires of the other country, mm-hmm. they might have big, big problems, right? Border conflicts happen a lot of places in the world. And I was thinking about these boundaries in much the same way, in that if you're thinking about the system as having these well-defined crossing points, that actually gives you a lot of freedom, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you now maintain the crossing points and the well-defined nature of them, you can feel free to change anything about the inside without fear that something that's going to break something somewhere else, right?
Exactly, yep.
And one of the conclusions we came to was the thinking about reuse. And, of course, one of the promised benefits of service orientation is that people will actually reuse these services. Mm-hmm. We found that people don't want to reuse services if the pain level is high, right? Like if I use your service and you know, every 6 weeks you do make some change and it breaks my thing and I have to go in a big fire drill trying to reason, that makes a lot of pain, okay? Mm-hmm. If the pain level is high, I'm just going to say, you know what, forget that. I am not using your service anymore, right?
Right.
So if we have to find a way where we can create services, share them, use them in a way that's as painless and friction-free as possible.
It's reuse is a big bonus for us, I think, in services. It's something that we're very interested in. We've, you know, as an enterprise architecture group, we have produced enterprise reusable components. You know, so we've got assemblies out there in the GAC they can reuse in the shared environments or put on their desktops. But services sort of give us the, you know, kind of that holy grail concept of reuse. You know,
yeah.
We can publish them, they're easily accessible. One of the things that we're working on right now, and maybe I can follow up with you if you're going to be a tech ed this year, I'll let you know what the work is, but we're taking some of our reusable components, the ones that make sense, and we're starting to factor those into services that people can access. Because, again, we have a heterogeneous environment, so right now we maintain multiple versions of these components for different environments. What we're thinking is if we can take some of the functionality of these components, move them into services, now we can get rid of all these different versions, leverage the service. But what the thing that we want to try to avoid is if we're talking about sort of standard enterprise entities, customer, wholesaler, retailer, those kinds of things, and we want to start to define, you know, lay out some of those definitions, we don't want you to have to go in and say, I need some data about this particular wholesaler and say, okay, now we're going to get, you know, this, all the data back that, mm-hmm. that we would offer. Because that's kind of what we're struggling with is when we define these entities, how can I say, well, really all I need is the name and I need kind of a PIN number and I need this. So we're working, some of the folks on our architecture team, we're working on this kind of selector pattern that would really allow us to say, okay, as the consumer, you agree to use this version of this entity, but you can tell us exactly what you need. We'll figure that out and return that back to you in a much more, you know, abbreviated format so you're not getting a lot of data back that you don't really need or want.
You know what I think is a great visual image for that is, okay, let's imagine we were doing that on paper. And so you give me a request form, and I put in the name, the ID number of the wholesaler I want, and then you have a bunch of check boxes. You know, do you want all their current outstanding invoices? Mm-hmm. Do you want, you know, whatever, you know, 10 other things that I could ask for, mm-hmm. right? And I say, no, I just need their basic information, right? And I give you this paper, and then you would give me back the report that fits exactly what I asked for.
Right.
I think it's okay to create a request that says, hey, we have this wholesale type, a wholesaler type. It mm-hmm. could have tons of stuff. It might have, you know, you could get back, you know, 5,000 invoices that they have open right now if you mm-hmm. ask for them. But don't ask for it unless you really want it because it's going to be a much slower call when you make that call, right? I think that makes a lot of sense. And then when you build this kind of entity aggregation layer that's going to support that, mm-hmm. It becomes a much richer model, because that's been the hard thing for people is, well, how big exactly should these entities get?
Right.
And then you always run that balance, because if you go off and grab everything you know about this thing, it's going to take forever.
Well, what the goal is to come up with one definition of that. So
yes.
That's, you know, someone actually proposed, well, maybe we could come up with this version of retailer, this version of retailer, this version of retailer for these different business units. And what I'd like to do is come up with retailer as a definition, but exactly what you're saying, be able to factor that request, say, I'm really looking for this piece, but you're still getting basically the retailer back, the one definition.
And it's okay in fact, in Windows Communication Foundation, the data contract supports the idea of mm-hmm. optional data members, right? So I can say, well, the array of open invoices is optional.
Right.
Right? And so you don't get it unless you ask for it.
Yep.
And it supports that wonderfully,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think that's a great model to go with.
Right.
Well, fabulous. I'm so delighted that, you know, it's fun for me to hear that this work has borne some fruit, you know, because sometimes I go off and, you know, speak at a conference or something and I get nice comments back and everything. I'm always glad for that. But I always think, well, does this really make any difference? Does it really help people out in the real world? So I'm glad to hear that it did.
Yeah, I'm grateful for this forum because, you know, being able to be here, I right after your talk, I was going to go up and talk to you and there suddenly the groupies just, boom, right, they're all around you. I thought, oh, I'll see if I can catch him in the cabana or something. So I was glad I had an opportunity to sit down and tell you about this.
Yeah.
I think it has had an impact. And like I said, it continues to evolve as we put these things into practice and say, okay, yeah, this works. And, you know, this is actually leading to something new that we may come up with.
You know what's fun about doing ArtCast is now you can get kind of this information like every day instead of waiting for once a year to be able to take
right. It
or something, right?
Exactly.
And so that's what's been really fun about this. And you know, we are nearing our first goal, major milestone of 250,000 downloads of ArtCast, which that's really cool. Yeah. I am really jazzed about that. In fact, I get nice notes from people in lots of parts of the world where they can't ever get over to an event like TechEd in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or even one of the ones that happens nearby them. Unfortunately, there's actually there's TechEds all over the place.
Sure.
You know, in places like Malaysia and South Africa and Korea and
there's
China.
Three in India, aren't there?
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, I don't get to go to all of them. If I could, my wife would kill me if I went to all of them. But anyway, it's great fun meeting you, and thanks so much for letting me know that this helped you.
No problem, Ron. Thank you very much.
All right. Denny Boynton, ladies and gentlemen. Patterns for SOA. You know, this whole thing about service orientation and the patterns and anti-patterns have just been fantastic. I mean, I am amazed at the impact this thing has had. I got email from all over the world from people who have seen this or heard about it or use these patterns. I'm just stunned. I never thought this would happen, okay? I just sat down one afternoon and kind of put together some thoughts, and a lot of them weren't my original thoughts. They were thoughts that I just heard other people saying, and it just seemed to me that somebody needed to put these together. I guess I was the lucky guy, but that's what happens when you're on ArtCast.